The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for April 6th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So it's been, I think we figured 4 weeks.
We're going into our fourth week of lockdown.
Yeah. So how have you been coping?
I've been coping, yeah. We're getting a puppy.
Yeah, you told me.
Yeah, you know, if you stay locked up with your family and your kid for that
long.
Dogs
are a real in-demand item right
now.
Yeah,
I learned that, thank God there's someone making money in Alberta right now. People selling dogs are doing quite well.
Dogs and toilet paper, that's who's making money.
Thank God there's something going on in the economy.
So what kind of dog did you get?
It's a small Labradoodle.
Male, female?
Female, but we're not getting it yet. You know, it has to still be with its mother for another month.
Oh, okay.
No.
Yeah.
Although, you know, they're getting so in short supply, people are putting deposits on unborn ones. But this one's born.
Yeah.
It just needs another month or something.
Right.
So we have time to prepare.
So you think you'll have it in time for camping season?
Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully, if we're camping, which is another question. So on the weekend was the time, if you wanted to book an Alberta campground, that you would need to get online. Usually you'd get online at like 6 in the morning the day of.
Yeah, everybody would just
you could get the July long weekend
wake up
camping.
Early, yeah, just to get that spot.
Yeah. So this, I had it actually in my calendar and I kind of forgot about it. And then at noon I was like, oh my God, I forgot to book the campsite for July long weekend. So I get on at about 12:30 and like 20% of the sites are gone, hardly any. In a normal year,
They'd be full up.
They'd be done. You wouldn't have got your site.
Huh.
So I guess Albertans are not banking on July long weekend camping. I don't know, Peter. Do you think I'll use my camping reservation?
I think you'll be able to use it. I'm an optimist. Okay. I think you'll be able to use it. You may be wearing a mask. I don't know.
We may be 2 meters away from all the other campers.
But you will be camping. If you're not camping by July, I think we'll have bigger problems. But as I said, I'm an optimist.
So, we'll revisit this in July.
We'll revisit.
See who's right.
Well,
I'm hoping
you're
right.
We'll revisit it by the end of May, but I suspect pretty soon those campsites will start filling up. So anyway, that's an inside piece of advice. There are campsites available, so go for it.
Yeah, book them up.
All right. So what are we talking about?
Well, we got to talk about this oil price rally on Friday. Oil price went from about $20 at some point last week to $28 at the end of the week because President Trump tweeted, Russia and Saudi are going to cut 10 million barrels a day. And there was the expectations that they would have a meeting today, actually, Monday, which actually over the weekend we learned that chances of that didn't look very good. It's going to be delayed and prices fallen a little bit, but it's still at this moment $26 a barrel higher than it was last week before any chance of a cut.
Yeah, I mean, last week, I mean, we were in sub $20 and now it's a
for
waste
a time.
Of, I mean, it's kind of an odd day when we start cheering $26 barrel oil. I mean, that is still incredibly low, well below the economic threshold for many producers around the world, certainly in terms of having enough cash flow to be able to drill more wells. From an operating perspective, many can survive at that level, but we've got some big issues at these current levels. So I'm not surprised that the producers are coming together to talk about. When is that meeting? Is it on Thursday, tentatively?
Well, today they're saying, yeah, it'll happen on Thursday, but who knows? Like, I think, let's talk about if it's likely that they have the meeting at all. The idea is that would be an OPEC plus Russia and others likely would need to be part of this cut as well, because I'm not sure that Saudi and Russia want to go on their own here. So how likely is it that we could get a deal? Interestingly enough, Trump hasn't said that he would try to help navigate the U.S. cutting. And there are some questions to, you know, certain states can cut, but
so,
others can't.
You know, there may be an American participation in this. I'm even hearing Canada's part of the dialogue, or at least listening in, the Norwegians.
Yeah,
others.
Norway came out and said they would potentially be interested to support a cut. I just think, well, first of all, let's talk about the cut. What happens if it were to be a 10 million barrel a day cut? Is that actually substantial? So as we've been saying for weeks here, every week we get together and the outlook for demand drop gets larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the same thing. I mean, today we're learning that there's an outbreak in Tokyo and the potential for Japan, a 4 million barrel a day oil market, to start to put in lockdown procedures.
Boy, they're late to the party.
They are, yeah.
I'm surprised their numbers haven't been higher. They've been seemingly, at least by the numbers and the news that I've been reading about them, sort of not all that concerned. But the numbers are starting to spike up there. So the last major economy that may clamp down. I mean, we've seen this coronavirus, COVID-19, go around the world in 80 days, right? We've seen it start in China, you know, go to Iran, go to Europe, starting in Italy, and then go across the Atlantic over to North America, United States. Now it's sort of making that final journey to the last major economy.
Yeah, which is it hit
Japan.
South America too.
Yeah, it hit South America.
So, you know, there are outlooks now that demand at this moment, it keeps getting, you know, it was 10 million barrels a day 3 weeks ago, then people said 20 million barrels a day last week. There are some estimates as much as 30 million barrels a day right now is being lost in terms of demand. And it really, you know, how big this implication is really matters in terms of the duration.
Yeah, well, the script that we described last week, a week ago today, on last Monday, is actually playing out. We said that we'll be looking over our shoulder at the Europeans, probably see an improved situation in terms of new case counts, number of deaths, et cetera. And indeed, things are looking better over there. I mean, it's kind of morbid to say, okay, the death count is down, but it is really important in terms of having validation that the isolation measures that have been taken across Europe are actually starting to work. And so every week that goes by, also you start to see the ability to move from shock and awe and crisis and then crisis management and now into the next phase, which is sort of controlling a flattened curve. And I think that a week now when we speak, I think we're going to see plans emerge from these countries as to, okay, how are we going to get the people back to work? Importantly, the other data points that we're starting to see, which we talked about last week, are the recoveries. There was very scant data and information on how many people had actually recovered, bearing in mind that it takes 3 to 4 weeks by the time you get infected and tested and go through this for some debilitating disease and recovery. It can take 3 to 4 weeks. Well, it's only been 3 to 4 weeks certainly for us here. And in Europe, it's probably been 5 or 6 in places like Italy. So now what we're seeing is a surge in the number of recoveries. And so how the planners are going to start thinking about getting people selectively back to work and so on, that's what we're going to hear about next week. Here in North America, we know the United States is still on the surge. It's very troubling, the images that we see on television, places like New York and so on. But the ability to manage the crisis is improving by the day. You'll still see the count go up. But the fact that we're looking over our shoulder at Europe and seeing that it is possible to improve the numbers and seeing that death count go down is a positive signal. Markets are up today. And I think a week from now, there will be more light at the end of the tunnel, although still uncertain how we're going to get to the end of the tunnel.
But we know for sure that Q2 is going to be a difficult oil demand month, right?
It's going to go well into the end of the Q2. I mean, I don't think that we're really going to get out of the full isolation mode that we're in, at least for probably 3-4 weeks is my sense.
And then kind of a gradual.
And then a gradual controlled thing. And then we're gonna look to the Europeans to see how they start doing it, to give us some sense and guidance of how we can do it. So from a perspective of oil consumption, okay, certainly there's not a lot of flying going to be going on. Borders are not going to be open for that international travel. And commuting, I don't see that coming back in a meaningful quantity, at least till the end of the quarter in a meaningful way.
Okay, so maybe we're between 20 and 25, maybe even 30 million barrels a day of lost oil demand if it stays like this.
Instantaneously, yeah.
Now, if this cut of 10 million barrels a day happened, does it really matter then? Like, it's such a small number relative to the problem.
Well, I think it will help in a sense that it would slow down the filling up of inventories. Because if, you know, we discussed last week, one of the big problems is that producers have nowhere to put this stuff. It's rapidly filling up. I mean, the slowing down of the filling up of inventory is really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that inventory can weigh down the oil markets for a long time to come.
I mean, it just leads to that really negative scenarios of potential system collapse where you just get very aggressive shutting in too much than is necessary. So actually, a measured pullback by agreement is not a bad thing. I'd say it's almost necessary. It's almost essential that that happen.
Yeah, I guess the danger would be that if we damage that productive capacity, and that includes the supply chains that support the oil and gas industry, we could set up the world for boom-bust cycles in the future. there's a discussion, as I'm sure you've seen, that we shouldn't put any money to help the oil and gas industry, that we should put all the money into green energy. But the reality is we're not actually off oil and gas yet. And if we come out of this and we damage the supply chain and it means that oil and gas is really expensive, that's going to hurt the ability to recover from this.
Yeah, and this is not just about emissions. I mean, we know that only 40% of a barrel of oil goes towards light-duty vehicles, commuting. I don't know, it's like 5% goes to flying, 5 million barrels a day. I mean, there's a very large percentage, 50% plus of oil that goes to really essential things, including making masks and medical equipment and diesel for truck drivers to deliver our food and supply chain. So to be nonchalant about our oil industry at a time when it does have the potential for severe system damage is not a good idea, because coming out at the other end of this thing, the last thing we want is system damage. And we've written about that. We've talked about that here.
And so would you support Canada and U.S. cutting their production to help towards this goal?
Well, I would. And those talks are going on. I'm not sure how effective they're going to be in terms of reaching some kind of agreement. I mean, what do you think?
I think it's definitely going to be hard, because these countries are dealing with other issues that are very important, like the COVID crisis. And so it's hard for me to see that they would dedicate all these different countries the time that it would take. But hey, desperate times call for desperate actions. Maybe this can happen, because this is a pretty serious situation.
It can. There's a lot of political mistrust between these countries right now, which is concerning. And, you know, maybe there will be some sort of agreement. And if there isn't, well, the price by itself, the $25, is not enough to keep a lot of production going for very long. And so there will be cuts necessarily. And actually, the price is already, I would argue, zero in some inland production facilities in different parts of the world, because it's being turned away. But I would say that I think we should also think about the ability of such a cartel, I'll call it a more globalized cartel, OPEC plus plus, maybe even plus, to be able to hold such production curtailment over the long term. And I would argue it's not even possible. I mean, so, I think near term, fine, it's necessary, but longer term, I don't think that the cartel model works anymore.
Well, so I totally agree with you. The plus, 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 like Canada, US, Norway, I don't see them being part of this.
No.
They have companies that are publicly traded, that are built on free market principles. But do you think that OPEC and Russia could come back long term?
No, I don't. I don't think so. I think that the two fundamental assumptions that have gone into cartel success, like OPEC and then OPEC plus, have been, number one, assuming that global demand can continue to rise year after year after year. So it's a growth market that they're feeding into. And number two, that when they curtail, that there's no challenge to their market share. Well, we know shale oil may be damaged, but it's not going away, right? Even oil sands and other challengers from around the world in the free market offshore.
Offshore has become very cheap.
Norwegians and North Sea, others. So, you know, the fundamental assumptions that have gone into what makes this unique cartel, arguably the most successful cartel ever in any industry, OPEC and OPEC plus, I just don't see the conditions precedent to make it successful going forward.
So you're basically saying, you know, with demand potentially being slower short term, maybe because of COVID, and long term because of transition, that you know, you don't have that growing market so that can absorb growth from others.
Yeah, we've written about it. We talked about it. Like, if you're Russian or you're Saudi, and you say, well, okay, I'm going to forfeit market share, prop up price, only to see my competitors, in fact, outright adversaries, if you're the Russians, take my market share, and I'm effectively, from their point of view, bailing out high-cost producers in Western countries. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, and if you think about it, like,
it doesn't make any sense.
Like, U.S. and Canada and the people that invested in these companies have actually got quite a gift from OPEC over the last six years. You know, OPEC has kept the price higher than it would be if they had not kept their barrels off the market. And I know we feel like a lot of producers haven't done, like, really great the last 5 years, but the prices would have been quite a bit lower
Lower. Yeah. No, effectively, Western producers across many countries in the free market have, you know, skied behind the proverbial boat in terms of the wake of higher oil prices. countries like Russia and Saudi and potentially others are saying, well, why would I do that? And so I think coming out of this, you're going to see lack of a cartel. You know, you might see a little bit of restraint on the part of Saudi to keep some spare capacity, but that our Western countries are necessarily going to have to adjust to a world where we can't rely on OPEC to be, quote, the swing producer as they have been in the past.
Well, that has big consequences. Companies have to, I mean, they're already focusing on being low cost. They're going to have to get better and better.
Not everybody's going to be able to share in that because some of them are just not going to be around. That's it, because there are going to be probably more episodes where you have these dips that will, you know, strain the companies that just can no longer compete. And you know, I'm not talking just about Canada or the US. I mean, this is just around the world. The industry is also going to be capital starved. In other words, the propensity for investors to put money into this space is going to be diminished. So basically, it's a very, what I call Darwinian survival of the fittest. But also in that context, though, it's also the strong get stronger.
The ones that are surviving today, are the higher cost ones will go away, but the ones that are low cost and nimble will do quite well.
They're going to do quite well. Yeah. And so basically the lesson is live long by not dying.
Yeah, just got to get through the valley.
But the first order of business here is really to get through this really deep valley. And you know, I'm hopeful that there is going to be some near-term agreement to be able to ensure that we don't have is like this permanent damage to vital supply chains.
Okay, but what happens if we don't? I think if there isn't an agreement, there's talk that the U.S. will slap tariffs on oil imports to protect the domestic market. In fact, President Trump this weekend said they could impose very substantial tariffs on oil imports. And Trump went on to say, if I did this, these tariffs, we essentially would be saying we don't want foreign oil. We're just going to use our oil, and that will help to save our industry.
Okay, so what does that mean? Is Canada part of the our oil equation as North Americans?
Well, I know Jason Kenney's been supportive of these tariffs, and I'm thinking he's thinking that Canada is going to continue to be there. You know, we're hoping we're not foreign, you know. First of all, I don't think that the U.S. really has the choice not to take oil from Canada, and I would actually throw Mexico in
too. Well, just by amount.
We supply 3.8 million barrels a day, or 56% of all imports. And our crude oil is quite unique in that it's heavy oil that is not easily substituted by other offshore suppliers. No. Crude oil is like coffee. There's lots of different types and grades, and our oil is quite unique. And I would actually throw
dark roast, right?
Yeah, ours is dark roast. And then we got the synthetic crude oil, which is unlike any other crude that a lot of U.S.
Like
refiners.
Decaf?
Yeah, maybe that's like decaf. A lot of refiners in the U.S. literally don't have alternatives. And then there's also the logistical challenges. We've talked about the Enbridge mainline many times on the podcast, but that is a pipeline that delivers as a sole source of supply for many refiners in the Midwest. If you couldn't get Canadian crude, logistically, there's massive challenges to get any other type of crude. And then on top of that, there wouldn't really be a good substitute available internationally. And so instead of creating market share for your domestic U.S. oil producers, for them to be able to supply that crude, you just see those refineries shut down because they're starved to death. Mm-hmm. They can't get the crude oil that they need for their diet. Therefore, they're just going to stop their operations or slow them down significantly. And that would mean less refined products for American citizens, less jobs. So I just can't see it happening.
Or if they somehow retool the processes to be able to take more of their own in these heavy oil refineries, it's just going to cost a lot more because the yields are a lot less, right?
Yeah, well, and you can't do that in the short term.
No.
You can't go reconfigure
a
plant. That would take many years. And a view that those tariffs are going to be around for a long time to make that capital investment.
Well, see, I mean, if you put tariffs on foreign oil, because I know there's been a lot of talk of let's put tariffs on foreign oil from Saudi oil coming here, or other places, even potentially Russia. There's some Russian oil that does make it into the United States. I mean, it just basically drives up the cost of the inputs into the refineries, and then that just trickles through to the consumer, which is also something that I know, or we know, that the White House does not want.
Mm-hmm. Although gasoline prices are so cheap now, it maybe won't matter, but later on, when prices start
but later
to increase.
On, I mean, you know, once you put these tariffs on, they're sticky, right? I don't know. I've been reluctant to think that this is going to work because of the issues that you pointed out, Jackie, the different kind of grades. All oil is not homogeneous. There's vast differences. And then on top of that, just what it would do to prices and how it would all trickle through the system. I mean, I don't think it's going to work.
You know what? I think it will. It could work potentially for OPEC and Russian barrels. I think there's more optionality there. First of all, just for context, the U.S. imported about 1.2 million barrels a day from OPEC Plus. So vast majority of that from Saudi Arabia, 500,000 barrels a day, Iraq, 300,000 barrels a day, and Nigeria, about 200,000 barrels a day. Very little from Russia, only about 130,000 right. barrels a day. Now, these oils are predominantly medium grade oils delivered to the U.S. Gulf Coast and the West Coast. Now, the crude oils that are in ample supply in the U.S., the crude oils from Texas, Colorado, North Dakota, those light, tight, hydraulically fractured oils are not a good substitute for these medium crudes right. that are imported from these countries. On top of that, there's logistical difficulties getting the crude oil to those places, A, because there's no pipelines, and B, because of this very old rule that in order to deliver oil from one U.S. port to another, you need to use a U.S. manned, purchased, and built ship that was called the Jones Act that required that. And that makes it really expensive to move American oil by tanker between places. So first of all, those oils aren't a good fit. Even if they were, it's expensive. Now, there are some oils produced in the U.S. that might be a good fit. The North Slope and some crudes from the U.S. Gulf of Mexico that might be a good fit. But they're not very much supply. I mean, you're talking about 1.2 million barrels a day that's of that grade, and the domestic supply of that grade is very small. Plus, it has the same logistical issues. So I think if you did that, it would hurt those countries somewhat, but it would also hurt your refiners who maybe in the global market, like the West Coast and U.S. Gulf Coast, the good news is they can access offshore crudes from other places. There may be other crudes in the world that could be a close substitute and they could swap some of that out. But as you say, I think it would increase the costs. They wouldn't be the ideal crudes. And so the refiners would probably be less efficient. And in the end of the day, it might cause prices at the pump to go up.
It would. I mean, I think assuredly it would. And in that regard, I don't know what the propensity is for either the American public or even the Canadian public to want to pay more for gasoline at the pump or whatever for the benefit of being self-secure.
Well, you know, I think, though, it wouldn't even do that, right? All it would do is allow you to depend on other offshore sources. This will not help U.S. producers. It will not create market for them. For example, why are they sending out 3.6 million barrels a day of exports from the U.S. and then importing, if you take out Mexico and Canada, importing 2.3 million? Because those refiners can't use those crudes. Right. If they could, they would. They would be the most right. economic. So it won't help the U.S. producers. It will, though, settle this fight. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be a way to have some retribution for right. OPEC and Russia waging this price war that's affecting U.S. producers. So right. they could accomplish a political win, but I don't think it wouldn't be positive for the economy. Right. Just for a note, though, Canada imports Saudi crude oil. I'm sure you've heard that little known
down
fact.
In the east at the Irving refinery.
Only 100,000 barrels a day or so.
That's a fair bit.
Yeah, should we slap some tariffs on that to stop the Irving refinery from taking that Saudi crude?
Well, I think it's a good question. Well, where would they get their oil?
Well, first of all, I mean, Canadian barrels wouldn't be able to fill it.
No.
We didn't build that Energy East, unfortunately, so we're not able to get the crude oil over there.
Well, we could do what we did in the 1970s. You know, I've got that story on my Energy File website, Long Way Around. We can post that. But we had tankers taking oil from Alberta through the Trans Mountain pipeline to Vancouver. Then the tanker went all the way around the Panama Canal through the Caribbean up the Florida coast and to the east. I mean—
Not economic, by the way.
Not economic.
I think what would happen is just like what happens in the U.S., they will find some other offshore
supply.
It won't be from Russia or Saudi Arabia. It may not be ideal for their refinery. They may have to run a little bit less crude through their refinery, but it's not going to really do much to help Canadian producers or U.S. producers, because if that type of crude could be used, it would be used by that refinery. Yeah. So the bottom line, we'll wait and see if that happens, but I don't sort of see it having the benefits to Alberta or to the U.S. Big news this week on the long-delayed Keystone XL pipeline. Did you hear?
I did. So shovels are in the ground, apparently.
Yeah. After a decade-long SAG, actually more than a decade, the next chapter is that the Alberta government is going to become an equity owner as well as provide a significant amount of debt funding to help push this pipeline along. Construction's going to start, and the Alberta government's actually going to cover a lot of this construction costs over the next year or so.
Well, there is a window of opportunity to get it done in this environment. And so I think that even though we've heard that it's been in the works, these negotiations with TC Energy for several months, the time to do it is now, given the current crisis and the need to get people to work and jobs and all that sort of stuff.
Well, and I think the reality is this pipeline would have a hard time finding funding any other way. I mean, there's a lot of risk associated with this pipeline. There's still legal challenges in the U.S. We do remember that Obama did cancel the Keystone XL, and so there's some concerns about the next election and would the next president want to try to cancel the pipeline. And I think it's a very important pipeline for Canada. So I believe, just like the TMX, there's too much risk here. You can't expect private investors to take this level of risk on. And so I think it's important for the government.
It is de-risking. That's important, but it's also de-risking from the perspective of diversifying our market access. I mean, that's been a long-standing debate. The current situation, which we talked about earlier, the Enbridge mainline carrying such a large fraction of our oil to such a concentrated region of the United States. You know, we used to say, oh, our issue is that we only have one customer, the United States. Now it's being revealed, not only is it just one customer, it's one subset of the customer in a very concentrated place. So we need TMX. We need this bullet line Keystone XL down to the Gulf Coast to give us the flexibility to be able to be more robust and resilient when we encounter times like this.
Yeah, I agree. By the way, the question I got last week many, many times from lots of different people is, do we still need it? And I would say, yes, we need that diversity of markets. If we had that today, we're suffering right now from crude oils backing up in Alberta because the demand is gone in the Midwest. We could send that oil down to the Gulf Coast and there would be more options for it, maybe to get on tanker or other places. And I would just say that all can do well. The KXL, they talked about having 500,000 barrels a day of firm contracts. Even though the line is 830,000 barrels a day, it probably will only flow closer to its firm contracts initially. The other systems can run where their firm contracts are. And if you assume the Enbridge mainline then takes all the spot capacity, all three pipelines can be actually fairly well utilized. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not all going to be full, but it's good. We need spare capacity.
Spare capacity with that redundancy is really important. I mean, in the electrical power world, there's all sorts of redundancies built in so that you don't have such concentration of energy, either supply or usage, in one spot and have alternatives to getting electrons to market through the grid. I mean, you need the same kind of thing on the oil side.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, last thing I want to talk about is just an update on the Canadian oil shut-in and refinery issue situation that we've talked about the last few weeks. We have seen with the April contract starting last week some examples of refiners that are announcing what they call force majeures, which is basically they don't want to honor their agreement to buy your crude in April. And they're saying to Canadian producers, in some cases, this is just starting, that because this issue has happened to me that's out of my control, like storage tanks being full or lack of demand for my product, I don't want to honor my contract. And so you're starting to see light oils come under a lot of pressure. This is predominantly affected light oils right now. In fact, the discounts for light oils in Western Canada are equal to heavy, which usually they're quite a bit smaller discount to heavy oil.
Right.
And I think that heavy is going to come under the same pressure. You know, so far it's doing okay because heavy oil makes more diesel and it's maybe in a bit more demand. But as the storage tanks start to fill here in Western Canada, I think you're going to see pressure on
those types. First of all, force majeure is used to be called act of God. In other words, stuff out of my control that is so devastating it affects my business.
Yeah, and I can't honor business deals I made a month ago.
Right. And usually a lot of high-value business deals, even lesser ones, have terms in the contract that say force majeure in the event of. So basically the determination of whether or not COVID-19 is a force majeure, I don't know why it wouldn't be. I mean, it's pretty serious, is going to be a contentious call, I think. But I think also a foregone conclusion that it is a massive act of God that has forced business failure.
Well, and the reality is if you're sitting there, for instance, you're a refiner and there's no demand for your products and your storage tanks for refined products are full and you agreed to take all this crude. Honestly, these crude contracts are done like a month or 6 weeks beforehand. You agreed to take that crude, but now you have no physical place to put it.
Yeah.
Like you can't receive it. What are you going to start putting it in? in rail cars or, I don't know, barrels around your site? You just literally can't receive it.
You have to shut it. I mean, the reservoir effectively becomes your storage facility.
In terms of storage builds, we are still watching those. There was a fairly significant build at the Cushing hub last week. Data for March 27th showed that Cushing built by 5 million barrels of the about 40 million barrels that we had space left for. I expect that fill rate is going to accelerate over the next few weeks, but that's the one thing we're watching because that is an important hub for Canada. As it fills up, it will mean that there's less options for Canadian crude.
And the measurement of that is lagged by a week, isn't
yes,
it?
Yeah. And unfortunately, we don't have any current data on Canadian storage. There is a company that does it called Genscape, but it's not publicly available. Mm-hmm. And we don't have access to it unless we get the odd snippet of information that somebody puts out in a bank report or something. So it is frustrating to me that in a time like this, we don't have better data on Canadian storage.
How can you have effective public policy if you don't have access to this sort of data publicly?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the Canadian Energy Regulator recently asked people to write letters about areas where Canada needs better data. And here's a great example. The fact that we're at a time like this, such a critical time, and just flying blind, data on our storage.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I mean, yeah. We just need an improvement in the transparency of this vital data.
Okay, well, on that, we'll just have to look at the U.S. data and assume the same thing's happening here because they have much better data. So I think that wraps up our podcast for this week.
I think it does. So get your camping spot.
That's right. July long, lots of spots open.
Something to look forward to amidst all this doom and gloom talk.
Yeah.
But it's been a good session, and we look forward to having another session next week with hopefully, as I said, a little bit of a brighter light at the end of the tunnel. Until then, everybody, we wish you to stay healthy and stay strong.
Thanks for joining the podcast. If you liked it, rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.